we think about the goals of practice, it's not about sitting on a cushion and just keeping our eyes closed and decreasing our stress, right? Mm-hmm. The goal, yes, really, when we practice is human connection, dissolving the mm-hmm. distinction between self and other, for finding mm-hmm. that non-dual relationship. And that requires awareness.
Effortless Mindfulness with Locke Kelly. Experience support for awakening as the next stage of human development through micro-meditations and conversations about non-duality, neuroscience, and contemporary psychology. Today, it's my great pleasure to speak with my friend and colleague, Dr. David Vago. David is a research associate professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University and a research associate at Harvard Medical School. David's also a founding member of the International Society for Contemplative Research. He has also been a fellow at the Mind and Life Institute, where he just returned from India, having met with the Dalai Lama, who's a passionate interest in this field of meditation and science. In this podcast, David and I enjoy a deep dialogue around the neuroscience of meditation and recent research on accessing non-dual awake awareness. At the end of the podcast, I will offer a short mindful glimpse called Effortless Focus. I hope you'll enjoy. So welcome, everyone. It's my great pleasure to have a friend and colleague, David Vago, here today to dive deeply into neuroscience and meditation and awakening. Hey, David.
Hey, Locke. Really good to be here with you today.
So we have a lot of friends in common, colleagues, and we cross paths. And, after COVID, it's nice to be able to begin to connect again, even if we start with this dialogue, but I hope to see you soon as well. So yeah. I'd love to hear. I know you're just back. When I emailed you, you said you were off to Dharamsala. So I'm sure I'm sure I would love to hear a little about that adventure and and what happened when you were there.
Yeah, sure. Happy to share. I was actually just looking back at our my history of emails with you. I'm trying to recall when the last time we were together. And I do remember fondly back, it was 2012, actually, that there was a great group of researchers who were meeting at NYU and talking about the science of meditation. And you were just starting to write your book, Shift into Freedom, right? That was the that was your first book on Dzogchen teachings, and you were really immersed into the science, really wanted to make sure that the science was incorporated into the way you thought about your teaching. So it was really nice to just revisit that briefly. So just great to be with you again in another format where we can dive deep into the science of meditation. So I've been associated with the Mind and Life Institute for many years, probably since 2005. And, you know, they are responsible for nurturing these dialogues between Eastern and Western scholars, scientists, and really trying to bridge the gap between the epistemologies that come from the Buddhist science and Western science. So whether it's neuroscience or clinical science or even anthropology, there's this sort of interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary integration that's happening with the Buddhist science in these dialogues. And they've been so critical to moving the field of contemplative science and science of mind, of integrative health, forward into more mainstream models that are going to better understand what consciousness is and how we treat people in psychiatric settings. So there's a lot of impact that these meetings have had on society, really, from my perspective. And this is the 35th anniversary of doing these dialogues with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. It may be one of the last, if not the last. He's now 87 years old. He's getting up there in age. We had less time with him. He used to have 4 days all day just talking dialogue, you know, with the scholars and scientists. And now it was down to 2 hours for 2 days where we were able to share with him some findings and then hear his reflections. And if anything, the one message that sort of comes out really strong is the same one he's basically been saying for many years, but he was honing in on this one message, which was that there are 8 billion people on this planet. And at the most basic, most fundamental level, we are all the same.
As you look at it from contemplative, direct experience, when we look at it from our dualistic mind, the first thing we see is difference, different culture, different language, different. But as you drop into first level of non-judgmental mindfulness and then into nature of mind or bodhicitta, you have that almost seeing through the eyes of the heart mind. And I guess in Sanskrit and India, that saying namaste means, you know, I recognize that in you, which is the same in me at the deepest level. And in some ways, that I think what he's saying, if we can drop in to this view and use contemplative science to support that, we'll see differently than our, you know, conceptual mind that is looking for difference and compare and contrast and compare and despair. So it's beautiful.
Yeah, there's a powerful part of our human nature to do the social comparison that we do, right? I mean, that is just fundamental to being human, you know, and there's evolutionary sort of implications of why we always tend to contrast or make these contrasts, so because it highlights the differences that we have. But when we talk about the sameness, what we can probably expand upon that, especially in the Dzogchen context, like what is sameness? Mm-hmm. And how do we not only explain it, how do we measure it, and how do we cultivate it in a way that we still have a self, right, that's individual, but recognize the level of non-duality between us,
right,
to find that human connection that's so important.
Yeah, and certainly that's, that difference, that's kind of why they use the word non-dual. Some people say non-dual is oneness. And I usually think, I bet they have a bunch of words for oneness in Sanskrit that they would have used if they meant oneness. But it means the simultaneously or both and, or in Buddhism, they say the two truths, the ultimate level of reality and the relative level are not two. That this, you know, pure awareness and this aliveness are seem different. But when there's an interdependence, when there's an experience of interdependence, that, you know, that what's called emptiness or interdependence is really just means that there are not separate things, that everything is interdependent. And in that way, we're not only the same as unique individuals, but we're connected. We're dependent on each other. And certainly you can see that then as you go into biology and, you know, looking at the earth and everything else, right?
When I talk about the science of meditation, I really say that if we think about the goals of practice, it's not about sitting on a cushion and just keeping our eyes closed and decreasing our stress, right? Mm-hmm. The goal really when we practice is human connection, dissolving the distinction between self and other, for finding that non-dual relationship. And that requires awareness. It requires an awareness of not only our self and self habits and our needs and wants and all the different things that are populating our mind, but an awareness of the other, and the empathic sort of connection that we develop allows us to have the perspective of what other people may be thinking. And then there's this global awareness where it's the metta perspective. It's the awareness of our own awareness, right? So where you're starting to have a greater perspective on your own mental habits, someone else's experience, and then your relation to the world around you. And you realize it's distorted in so many different ways.
Yes.
So that's I think that's a powerful way where Dzogchen provides a lot of insight.
Yeah, the Dzogchen and Mahamudra view certainly changed my life. I had started, like many, with Zen and with insight meditation, studying in Sri Lanka for 9 months, doing 21-day retreats, 10-day retreats, studying in university there with professors in Kandy, Sri Lanka, and then going back up to the monastery and meditating, coming back again, and then going to meet, actually, the Dalai Lama up in Dharamsala, who had just come back from teaching for the first time ever Dzogchen in France. And he had just given this talk. So he was so enthusiastic about it. There was a group of about, 45 of us or so. And I just shot my hand up and I said, who do I go study with? As one of the, he only had 5 minutes for questions. And I was like, let me just go ask him this because I'm not going to get to him in person. And he said, Toku Ergen in Nepal. So changed all my plans, off I go. And then, within the first climbing up to Nagi Gompa little house and just having 12 of us in this little room, and he gave this little talk and this pointing out instruction and just shifting my awareness and then having it turn around and look back to who sent it and who was aware from a mindful witness, it kind of popped the meditator, opened into this vast awareness that was then embodied and connected. And I just started kind of laughing and crying and felt like, this is how I felt at the end of a 21-day retreat. That was less than 21 minutes, And so that gave me this pointer that there's some innate awareness rather than what they call the constructivist, that you need to develop this kind of awareness, that there's attention, and then there's metacognition, which is thought being aware of thought, then there's meta-awareness, but then even that meta-awareness as a witness, when you look back through it, it opens up that point of view or that, what I call the witness protection program, and then there's this almost infinite and intimate landing back in this embodied, interconnected feeling, as you're saying, that has connection as its source. And, we can talk a little about the experiment. One of the markers of that in terms of neuroscience is the task mode network, which is turned on by one-pointed attention, and the default mode network both balance. I mean, it's alternate. Yeah, if you sit on a subway or try to watch your breath, you'll go in and then you'll go out. And it's the brain regions are, it's not one part of the brain, but it's literally these two, networks. So then that tendency of the one-pointed attentional watching your breath, which people call mindfulness, but actually it's shamatha. It's not the four foundations of mindfulness, which is actually establishing the next preliminary practice, which is, establishing a mindful awareness that's able to watch thoughts, feelings, sensations, and mind objects come and go. The first part, and that's actually more traditionally mindfulness in the bigger scope of Buddhism, but people say, well, what is mindfulness? It's focusing on your breath, and when your mind wanders, bring it back. But that's actually, you could call it maybe baby mindfulness or beginner's mindfulness, but it literally is reinforcing, I think, the ego-centered strength. So a strong ego to be able to do a task, which then can do a task in the world. And it becomes, can be such a difference when people go on a 5-day retreat and then are asked, okay, watch your breath now. Notice where you're focusing on. Now begin to notice where's the focuser? Is there a focuser that's a solid object that was the subject watching your breath? Or is that not actually a solid thing? And as Willoughby Britton study then shows that around 40% of people, when they do that mindfulness in a 5-day retreat, not only deconstruct their ego identity, but their ego defenses, and they get flooded by unconscious material, and they have what's called the dark night. And so the non-dual direct introduction from the beginning kind of introduces, okay, don't just stop at deconstructing the self. Here's this other awareness that you now can be aware from that is not just a meta, but actually is an inherent same taste awareness that feels, and this is getting back to the default mode and the task mode, it feels like the default mode and task mode are on at the same time. So it feels seamless, and it feels like I'm not looking from above or from that, you know, like a witness. It feels like almost like being in flow. It feels like there's an interconnectedness, time slows down. There's a trust of an intelligence that's not self-referential or metacognitive and not even meta-awareness, that by awareness dropping into, like it does with flow, when you know something with implicit memory, a task that you love, that you've done so much, you don't have to create a witness. There's a kind of a natural, joyful, open-hearted intelligence. And that, from there, that awake flow is where compassion kind of starts coming online while you're also optimally functioning.
We highlight this idea of transcendence, which the way we define it is developing a positive relationship between self and other that transcends self-focused needs and increases pro-social characteristics. And then we've expanded upon this idea, and this is where maybe it really relates to you and your work and your listeners on what self-transcendence really refers to, this whole self-transcendent experience and these sort of temporary mental states that may operate along a spectrum of intensity. It ranges from the routine kind of experience of losing yourself in music or books, these flow states, these experiences of being in the zone, to the more intense and potentially transformative ones that are feeling not only connected to everything and everyone, but also to the aspects of self-dissolution, where the self feels like it's breaking down. And those experiences in life happen when people meditate or when they're experiencing something like awe. And these self-transcendent experiences have been referred to in the psychological literature for generations, really. I mean, William James talking about we can experience union with something larger than ourselves, and that union, in that union, we find the greatest peace. You know, and he talked, William James, you know, one of the forefathers of psychology, of behaviorism and psychology as a science, in the varieties of religious experience, talks about this idea of feeling oneness with everything, and that where you lose the boundaries of your physical body. And so this is kind of where I think we were heading with our discussion on non-duality, right? Yeah. So we have this duality always with us in our experience of the world, right? So we have our experience of the world through our senses, and that's just one perspective on the reality that that surrounds us. And it's biased, it's distorted. And there's so many ways we can talk about the distortions of our experience. But from the Buddhist perspective, and you can expand upon this, I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this, Locke, is from the Buddhist perspective, this is meditation is one of the goals is to remove this veil of ignorance, vipassana, right? Get insight into the nature of our mind is very limited. It's very focused on our conscious experience and nothing beyond that. But there may be this objective reality that exists without a conscious mind to experience it in any way. There's this aspect of realization, awareness of this awakened state, this Bodhi experience, or there's so many different ways to describe awakening, right? And from the Buddhist traditions, whether it's something that's transformative and fleeting, like from the Zen tradition, Kensho, or is it more the Theravadan tradition to talk about it as stream entry, or realizing the nature of mind? There's different ways to explain or to describe this characteristic of awakening, right?
Yeah.
The question that comes up often is, okay, well, what happens after that maybe fleeting temporary state of awakening, of some version of realization of how you are in relation to all things, removing the veil of ignorance, gaining some insight? Do you become, you know, you go off and just experience that blissful luminosity somewhere on a mountainside? Or do you then feel compelled to be altruistic in your motivation and try to bring more people to see that kind of experience, right? That enlightenment, that awakening, right? And with through compassion.
Yeah, beautiful. So, yeah, one interesting, you know, so it is that, you know, the thing that hasn't been really mapped or even that well described is, you know, when you get to, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, especially the direct path traditions of Mahamudra, Dzogchen, they have this type of awareness called Rigpa, which is non-conceptual awareness that is then first described as awareness of awareness itself, so not being conscious of being aware, which is what you call meta-awareness. Not that, oh, I'm conscious that I'm aware. Sometimes that's called awareness of awareness, but this is now when the awareness that's pointing toward consciousness turns around and looks back to see, is that a point of view or a meditator, or is there actually some more boundless awareness that's effortlessly already here? That then, interestingly, the next stage of Mahamudra is that from pure awareness is called same taste or simultaneous mind, where, oh, the awareness is not just pure, it's arising. Things are not moving through it like in OM or choiceless awareness, where you're in kind of a big sky mind. It's more like ocean and wave. Like thoughts, sensations, feelings, energy is made of the awareness. That's why you feel interconnected. So those two things are just so hard. How do you even get them on the map of, because many scientists, let alone even a lot of meditators, are like, well, I don't know what that awareness of awareness, I just know how to calm my body and I can watch, I can see there's no self, but I don't, like, what is that thing that is aware of itself, by itself, as itself, and is the kind of inherent, innate awareness? Is that anything? I mean, there is something called NDA, non-dual awareness, which some are describing, and I was in an experiment with Zoran Josipovic, where he was looking at the marker of the, I think the word is for the task mode and the default mode, that they're not anti-correlated. They're anti-correlated or not anti-correlated. So
I would just unpack a few of those things. So you mentioned meta-awareness, right? And so last time we talked a little bit about the differences between meta-awareness and metacognition, you know, one being sort of non-conceptual, right? The non-propositional, it's second order, it's embodied, it's an experience as a form of experience itself, right? It's not entangled in the contents of awareness. Right. Whereas metacognition is more about propositional, conceptual tracking of one's own experience. Right. I am not paying attention, for example, is a way to start thinking about your own thoughts or thinking about your own experience. So it's thoughts. And that's an important distinction between the cognitive, the metacognitive and the meta-aware perspective. But, you know, I'm curious with your, since you, a lot of your teachings with students focus a lot on in developing the mind, stabilizing the mind so it can be prepared to experience something like meta-awareness, I wonder where you typically start, because when we describe how that experience of meta-awareness and awakening, that those insights, those deep, profound insights of being connected to all things, in order to get to that place for people, there has to be a beginning point, right? And so if you think about depression or anxiety or typically thoughts that are ruminative in nature, you know, core beliefs about oneself, such as, I'm not good enough, or I'm a bad person. Mm-hmm. Something that you feel driven is driving your constant default mode, meaning that this is something mm-hmm. that is constantly circulating in your mind when it's, you know, at a state of rest or passive kind of mind wandering. Mm-hmm. So if you have this thought, I'm not good enough, there is this reified sense of self that I am mm-hmm. just not a good enough person. I'm not mm-hmm. qualified to do many things, right? That thought becomes part of your identity. Mm-hmm. And when we, at least from my understanding, when we talk about that as a thought, we teach people how to separate or provide a decentered mm-hmm. approach to looking at one's thoughts from a distance and say, I am not my thoughts. I am having the thought that mm-hmm. I am not good enough. So there's your metacognition.
Yes.
And then the meta-awareness is the not only the disidentification from that experience of I'm not good enough, mm-hmm. right? So it's no longer driving the stress and reactivity in your body that happens when you start feeling I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, and saying it to yourself. It's together that reduce reactivity to the thought content, right? And that disidentification from that experience internally, right, as separate from oneself mm-hmm. becomes more of a non-conceptual experience of meta-awareness. Is that similar to how you describe it with your students when you're teaching?
Yeah, that's very good. And I would say, having been through different systems that do those kind of steps, it's almost like pulling back a camera. Like you're in the scene mm-hmm. of the movie, and then you pull the camera back, and then you see that the characters are thoughts, is the first thing. And then the question is, when you go to meta-awareness, where are you located? So are you located in another point of view? Are you located in this choiceless awareness, big sky? Or have you kind of opened and kind of come back so you're aware from both outside and within? So those are kind of three, you know, I could say three different types of meta-awareness. And certainly the distinction of keeping pulling the camera back, I would say you can go to, in psychology, self-awareness is the ability to, I shouldn't touch the hot stove, right? Like, who's the I and who's the one, who are you talking to? And then you become aware, self-aware. Oh, I've split off and talking to myself. Now you can go to the mindful witness and realize, oh, that's a thought, I shouldn't touch the hot stove, there isn't. And then meta-awareness could then pull back to a kind of choiceless awareness or big sky awareness where things are moving through it. And then I think there's another one, which is to realize, oh, that awareness isn't just a kind of camera. Look back, who's behind the camera? Oh, there's nobody behind the camera. So then it just kind of opens and then comes back, you know, so there's this, oh, you know, there's a kind of centerlessness everywhere, nowhere, and here. That's where it starts feeling interconnected in a way that, you know, starting to talk about this Rigpa rather than just forms of attention.
Yes, yes. This is the critical distinction, right? So we start with this problem of having thoughts that fuel our anxieties and fears. Mm. There's this decentered perspective. And in fact, the decentering scale that we use in psychology to measure that critical therapeutic mechanism of insight, because when we're tangled up into our own thoughts and those thoughts reify to produce our self-identity, I'm not good enough, I'm a bad person, I'm an angry person. Once we create our self-identity with those thoughts, we can measure that shift through in a therapeutic context. And that's usually where it starts, this insight. And it's only the beginning, because you have to get to this point of being able to actually see that you're not your thoughts, right? That you're consciously aware of your body as a whole, that you're seeing things from a wider perspective, that you accept you as you are without those thoughts necessarily. You notice that you don't take challenges or difficulties or people who say things personally such that it affects your own identity, that you have this this core that is not your beliefs or not your thoughts. You can separate yourself from those thoughts.
Yes.
Once you're able to do that, then that's where you start loosening up the characteristics of our self-identity to move beyond the self, like Dogen was saying.
Yes.
Right? And then you can start moving into how you relate to others.
Yeah. And so, you know, just to add another layer from, you know, we're doing meditation and neuroscience, but we're also doing meditation and psychology. So a lot of what I notice is, you know, most of meditation research is about Theravada Vipassana insight meditation, and not much yet, but also the psychological system that's often related is almost, you know, cognitive behavioral, like Beck and cognitive, most mindfulness-based psychotherapy is just a cognitive movement of that. But now there's a lot of what are called, you know, subpersonalities or parts-based psychology. I work with, you know, that's where I come from, that school. So the move would be the same first move of, okay, there's this thought, feeling, sensation pattern that's saying, I'm not good enough. You pull back. Now you can see it's thoughts, but then now you can see, oh, it's not just a thought. It's a mind object. It's a mind state. It has, it's, you know, as, you know, in the trauma research, like Bessel van der Kolk talks about, the body keeps the score. It's kind of trapped in a time warp in your body that was when it was formed. And if you treat it as a thought, you can kind of zap it away, but it's most people it will come back. But if you treat it like it's a part of you that has a worldview, thought, feeling, sensation, and you start to relate to it the way it thinks it is, but not as you, it thinks it's all of you. But when you make the first mindful move, you're able to see, oh, it's thoughts and it's not me, it's part of me. Now can I, you know, listen to it, be with it, unburden it from its belief that it's still back in childhood, it still has, that its formation is, so you start to almost do a next level of healing of that part so that it relaxes and becomes part of you that is still young, but not so burdened and not having to hide in the shadow and then come up when it's triggered.
Yeah, and that's when you start to see the real shift for meditators. And if we want to, you know, move into the neuroscience that supports this, what you typically see in a meditator is, well, let's just back up here. If you look at brain network dynamics as supporting meta-awareness, we want to start with just, what does the brain look like during a passive resting state? When you're asked to do nothing and just let your mind freely wander, there is a type of analysis that neuroscientists do called independent component analysis. And that analytic techniques allows us to identify at least 10 different brain networks. And that's, you know, we parse the brain into about 264 anatomical regions, and this is done first by Corbinian Brodmann, who was an anatomist who really parsed the brain into these function, or really just these anatomically different brain regions that looked, that had delineations that were different in terms of how the cellular structure aligned. So he's able to make these different regional specificity through just anatomical analyses. Mm-hmm. And then through neuroimaging, we've taken those loosely based anatomical distinctions and created different, basically just independent anatomical regions that are now part of a standard map that we use in neuroimaging to look at how these different regions communicate with each other. And when we look at those 264 anatomical regions through a passive resting state, we're able to identify at least 10 different networks. And those networks all reflect very specific functions that show that those regions are active together temporally, and that they reflect very specific functions. So language, attention, executive functioning, salience, sensory motor activity, or mind wandering, really. When you're mind wandering or in this sort of evaluative, self-reflective state, the one network that comes up out of the 10 is called the default mode network. It's very active during that passive mind wandering state, mostly because, as you mentioned before, with your experiment with Zoran Josipovic, they were very interested in that mind wandering state and how active it is in meditators. And him, as well as others, for example, Judd Brewer, have also seen that brain network is less active in meditators, meaning that there's just less time spent in that network evaluating the world and focusing on self-reflection or autobiographical self-related activity. And that doesn't mean that meditators shut off that network completely. It just means that there's not as much emphasis on that kind of activity in a meditative mind. And if you really start to get into the granularity of how these networks interact, you start to see how there's actually more coordination happening, more flexible switching between networks in meditators' brains. And so when you look at, for example, there's one network called the frontal parietal network, which is associated with more higher order attention, prospective memory, meaning setting an intention to do something in the future, like I'm going to go take out the trash later and walk the dog. And then I'm going to put that into the background, have our conversation, and then remember to do it later. That is a very higher order form of prospective memory functioning at this frontal parietal network, which just means the frontal lobes and the parietal lobes are coordinating together to support this kind of functionality. That network in itself has been shown to be the most influenced by meditation, and there are parts of it, including the frontal polar cortex, right in the front behind the forehead, the insula, which is sort of deep into the temporal lobe area. It's near the frontal and temporal areas, and it's a structure that's really associated with body awareness or interoception, so being able to keep track of what's happening in the internal milieu, as well as related functional states of feelings or emotions, and higher order social interactions. So that insula works together with the frontal polar cortex and parts of the parietal lobe that are really important for localizing yourself or your body in space and time. And together, that network is a hub. And what we find is that there's extensive connectivity between the default mode network and the frontal polar network or frontal parietal network, and that supports this ability to flexibly couple between all the other networks. We said there's 10 networks, and so there's this skillful toggling back and forth between conceptual and propositional, which is happening in that default mode network activity. So it's really evaluative what's happening in the world. And then the toggling between the non-propositional processes and networks that are supporting not only this higher order awareness or meta awareness,
right?
But then also what's happening in the world, the sensory experiences, right, the language network. So all those other networks have to be coordinated. And that frontal parietal network seems to be a critical hub to facilitate that toggling, right, between all the necessary network supporting activity, maybe for sensory or sensory motor or for language, whatever our mind is drawn to as we mind wander or as we are moving through our lives. There has to be a coordination, and there has to also be a circuit breaking function that happens. And this frontal parietal network not only facilitates intrinsic connectivity with that default mode, so it helps these iterative loops of self-reflection and evaluation that are happening often without awareness or without volition in mind wandering. It helps break that down so that there's awareness and insights to what's happening at any moment, so you can switch out as the motivation to do something else is driving you towards maybe paying attention to something else in the room. Like we talked a little bit about some of the blindness or the perceptual biases that we have, that meditation allows us to become more aware of those things that's happening. But it's not that we're just suppressing that default mode. It's necessary to evaluate. It's necessary to have some way to see what's happening in one part of our conscious awareness, evaluate it briefly, and then come back to wherever our motivation is calling us. And that coordination has to happen.
Yeah. Yet the senses of the anti-correlatedness is that it feels like I'm aware of what's going on inside and I'm aware of what's going on outside simultaneously, seamlessly. So I'm not aware of what's going on inside. It's definitely less, but there feels to be this not switching of what's going on out here, what's going, you know, they often talk about it as extrinsic network, intrinsic network. So extrinsic and intrinsic is happening at the same time. So I'll walk around, and if I check my mind, like if I stop, I have no, my automatic thoughts have been trained to go into the background. So right now I have no thoughts on my mind, but all of a sudden, like you said, don't forget to bring your keys, you know, or oh yeah, you're going to pick up this at the grocery store and that, and then it'll just go down. So the implicit memory is, right. And I'll give you one more example, which is really interesting. So I had COVID and then I had long COVID, some symptoms. Yeah, so I had some symptoms, and one of the symptoms, brain fog, was so interesting in terms of this because it literally was like a drain on the system, like a pull, like not sleepiness, not tiredness, not, but almost like, you know, the battery on a phone just goes. And so I couldn't remember things. My brain wasn't working, but if I taught, I was like funny, talking clearly, everything came out, remembered everything, could quote anybody. So I would shift into this other operating system that wasn't the attentional everyday mind of memory and trying to do things from this first vehicle, almost. I call it like a, you know, the small car. I went into the other vehicle and then everything was fine. And I could clearly do, especially, you know, teach and be with people for 5-day retreat, and I was just fine. And then I learned how to carry that through. So if I look at my brain, it's like not doing so great, but it's almost like having a foot that's asleep. You know, that if you're sitting, it's okay. So yeah. What do you make of that?
Yeah, there's a big element. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, you know, experience with COVID and long COVID symptoms and brain fog. That, you know, we're still getting a better sense of our understanding of why that happens. A lot of it has to do with just our arousal system too, where it's, you know, because we're fighting a large, you know, virus, right, in our bodies, and the virus sits in all of our organs, especially our brain too. There is an energy depletion. It consumes a lot of energy to deploy your immune response. And so that's where that energy has to come from, somewhere, that energy. And you only have so much energy, right? You have your brain is 2% of your body weight, but consumes 20% of your brain's energy.
Right.
So it requires a lot of energy to do the work it does. And the immune system, certainly when it is and engaged and fighting bacteria or a virus, it's going to consume a lot of that body's energy. Mm. And that's going to, you're going to feel it in your cognitive capacity, right? Yeah. So that's a whole nother podcast probably to talk about how we deal with that.
That's right.
But the meditation part of that, you know, where the fact that like you can drop into that state of discursive mind wandering where you have one thought leads to another thought that leads to another thought, and that you're just constantly distracted, right? There's just objects that arise and are sticky, right? You get stuck on a thought and it just starts taking you down a rabbit hole and you can't get out of it because you don't even have awareness that you're there. That's our typical experience. And the subtle difference that we see in, say, mind wandering versus an open monitoring type of style of meditation is this awareness piece, right? It's like the awareness and a level of control such that during an open monitoring meditation, there is sustained attention. So you're focusing on any object that arises in your mind, and you're allowing it to arise and pass. And this arising and passing, of course, is part of the Theravadin tradition, one of these sort of stages of insight. So how do we learn to how to just monitor objects as they arise and pass without getting, you know, sucked in or let them being really sticky? And from the neuroscience point of view, what we find is that, you know, because meditation is really flexing activity, when I say flexing, I just mean it's utilizing this frontal parietal network a lot to meditate. We know that the frontal parietal network is important for setting an intention to do something in the future, putting it into the background, so much so that if you were to say, I want to wake up, you know, in the morning at 6 a.m., you wake up sometimes before your alarm because you put it into the intention, and that network is responsible a lot for that form of prospective memory. So this network not only facilitates the sustained attention, but inhibits the selection of non-target objects like distraction. And that's by doing that and through meditative training, you're able to allow all these thoughts to arise, but also pass very quickly. If you are stuck in mind wandering without awareness, just passive discursive mind wandering, you get stuck by one thought and that'll take you down a rabbit hole and you may miss all the forms of, you know, sensory experience that are happening around you. Sort of a different level with anxiety, when you're really anxious, you have a thought that you can't get rid of. Right. You're so focused on one thought or set of thoughts that everything else also disappears. So the concentration or the sustained attention may be there, but you're no longer, and you're maybe inhibiting this, the non-target objects of distraction, but you're no longer aware of the ability to allow something else to arise and notice it, right? With meditation in an open monitoring practice, you can focus on an object and sustain attention very well. You can inhibit the selection of non-target objects, but you're also open to objects as they arise. So if you're going to notice something, you're going to allow it to arise and without getting stuck on it. So it's unique from not only the mind-wandering discursive state, but it's also unique from that anxious state where there is a focus and an ability to inhibit the selection of non-target objects, but you no longer have the ability to sense whatever else is in the environment. You're no longer aware of the things that are rising and passing. And you see that in the brain very clearly.
Okay.
With the frontal parietal network basically coordinating the circuit breaking function to allow you to switch as needed, but then also some of these central executive network areas, like the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, which are on the bottom and side of the brain, frontal part of the brain, and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which allows you to sustain attention, right? And then it's the frontal parietal, which allows you to toggle. And then all the other networks are just part of support for any other sensory experience that you have.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely feel that and experience that. And it's interesting that there are the, you know, like the progressive stages. If we were going to go from FA, you're kind of using the flashlight, to open monitoring. Now you're able to watching arising and passing. But when you go to NDA, it's actually, it almost, they say, don't particularize. and you actually are processing it without, kind of like in a what I call panoramic flow state, like skiing on, you know, on super difficult, because you're processing all information without processing, without noticing the particularity of it. So it feels like there's another system, and they say it's like all at onceness, that there's a sense of everything being managed on its own. And it's not a pre, you know, as if the seeing of it particularly is the higher form. This is the next level of allowing that all to be processed by an intelligence that doesn't need to know all the particularity and is making the discriminating decisions about which information needs to be watched or not. So that's kind of the, you know, and that, you know, that even shows even the difference between, like, if you do mindfulness with an EEG machine, you can go, you know, from beta to alpha, right? You know, so the more beta, fast moving, to the calmer, right?
Yeah. Just to clarify what happens in the brain too, with EEG. So we talked a little bit about brain networks, right? So we said there's 10 networks. The default mode network is one. Frontal parietal network is another. And their central executive network is another. And these networks are coordinated through meditative practice, moving from conceptual, metacognitive to the non-conceptual meta-awareness. And that you see those changes. You can see those changes in the brain of meditators, in the sense that those networks are, I think it's pretty clear how those network dynamics function with each other, and the frontal parietal network is really important for flexible switching. From an EEG perspective, is what happens, you know, in terms of brain activity. And EEG, really, electroencephalography, really just helps you look at populations of neural activity in time. So it's very good temporal resolution, doesn't have as good spatial resolution. It's hard to locate where that activity is coming from, but you can see when it's happening much better with EEG, whereas fMRI, you can see it much better spatial resolution, where it's happening, but time is very bad. Very good, bad at seeing when things happen. So with EEG, when you just close your eyes and just start to relax, you move from that beta state, which is what you mentioned, which is really fast mixed amplitude activity, to a slower 8 to 12 hertz alpha activity. And alpha is really about just relaxed wakefulness. You see that kind of brain activity when you're in relaxed wakefulness. Now, as you move into more meditative states where there's more concentration and stable attention and awareness, then you move into a little bit lower frequency, higher amplitude alpha, which is about, you know, 7 to 9 hertz, 7 to 10 hertz. Between that range, you'll start to see high amplitude alpha, just but at the lower spectrum of alpha, 7 to 10. And that's when you start to see focused concentration. And that's been shown very clearly in various traditions. Now, as you move into more concentrated, deeper stages of awareness and attention, you move into theta. Now, theta is about 4 to 8 hertz. So 8 hertz being like the sweet spot, really, for theta. And that state is much more about these flow states, where you're really sort of in the zone, right? You're less distractible. So anything that's really embodied and in this kind of zone or flow state would be, you can probably see the brain activity is in that sort of theta level, right? And, you know, then, you know, as you continue, and it's really in the midline structures of the brain where you see that focus. So meaning much more in the central parts of the brain. And the idea is that it's coming from mostly frontal and midline, that it's coming from this monitoring network or salience network. So your dorsal anterior cingulate and parts of your frontal polar cortex are critically involved in stabilizing that attention. And that's where you'll see frontal midline theta. So frontal midline theta and alpha are the two main brain correlates of EEG that you see in meditation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's plenty of studies now that even correlate the frontal midline theta activity with clinical outcomes in meditation training intervention. Now, gamma gets a little bit more complicated, and I even had a conversation with Wolf Singer about this when I was in Dharamsala not too long ago. And so the gamma is a little bit harder to understand because gamma band is like 60, is usually above like maybe like 30 to like 90 hertz, right? It's really higher frequency type of activity in the brain. And it just really reflects much more coordinated activity across the entire brain. Usually it's associated with gamma between different brain regions. You'll often see a synchrony there in the gamma spectrum when there's a coherent kind of image that comes together, or like a gestalt of a concept that comes together, an aha moment. Yeah. You'll see a little bit more gamma. Yeah. It's harder to measure because you often, not only is there a 60 hertz filter that you have to be worried about because it's noise, but there's also noise that you get when you measure it in frontal lobes, because you often see changes in your facial musculature that interfere. But what there has been shown, and Richie Davidson's been one of the only labs to really show this, is that when you're in this non-dual, non-conceptual state of awareness, that they measured it in a non-referential compassion meditation, which is really just about, you know, wishing all sentient beings to be free of suffering, but in a very non-conceptual way. It's just a feeling of just a, it's a very
It's ultimate bodhicitta. It's not like loving kindness meditation that you actually go into the non-dual and then it's almost like it arises naturally and you just kind of.
And it's an important distinction.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that, but it's very non-conceptual. Then you see that, then you see an intense change in gamma band activity, and it matches with the phenomenal experience of clarity, which is the, you know, how well your contact with that state. If they report that there is a stable, high level of phenomenal clarity with that state of awareness, there's more gamma.
Yes.
And so that's important to keep in mind. And that hasn't been replicated as much as the frontal midline theta or the low frequency high amplitude alpha, but it's certainly a correlate that we see with non-dual awareness. So I just wanted to make sure that we throw that out there.
Yeah, no, that was really helpful to hear that. I think that's one of the research projects I'm so fascinated with, because it was able to show, I mean, it's just EEG. I wonder what would have been seen, you know, if you did fMRI and been looking for certain things, but it certainly shows that there are stages beyond, you know, that even these students who I know them, many of them are not like super long-term meditators. Some of them are just naturals. They just took to it and they're able to do it. And are you able to do it? Yes. Okay, check. Yeah, this, you got that? Yeah. Some of them are just, you know, 1 to 3 year practitioners. And yet they're able to go to what Richie Davidson had said, that Mingyur Rinpoche was, you know, the happiest man in the world because he had synchronized gamma, you know. So, you know, so this is this is pretty incredible to hopefully continue to look at these practices, you know, as something that is learnable without becoming a monk.
Yes, of course, everybody wants to be able to learn these skills, not just in a monastic setting. So I wonder, maybe you could expand a little bit about your idea of panoramic flow versus, what was the other form of flow that you're
Absorbed
to?
Flow. Yeah, absorbed flow.
Absorbed and panoramic. Could you maybe unpack those a little bit more?
Sure, yeah. And so absorbed flow, I mean, it's pretty clear. You can see when Csikszentmihalyi and others are talking about it, you know, you immediately, somebody gets involved in a task, they get absorbed in it, they're totally lost. They're able to do it at an incredible, some of the same markers are there, optimal functioning, joy, sense of ecstasy, non-ego. But what happens is they're closed in, they're absorbed, kind of like one of the jhana practices of FA. And then they look up and time has passed. Oh my God, I was there for 2 hours? That's amazing. So panoramic flow is, in terms of time and focus, is where it starts being different. So like a point guard on a basketball team is dribbling down, they know the time, they see the crowd is there, They see all their players, the defense, they feel it, and time slows down. Now they're in the now. They feel and see everything. They can look one way and know that their teammate has just gone around the defender, and they throw the ball up, and it all is interconnected. So it's more interconnected rather than absorbed, and it's more open and in the world rather than down into, you know, a kind of a task.
So when you talk about absorbed, are you also, do you think about it as that non-target objects, right? So distraction, anything that's in the environment that could be that could form a distraction is inhibited, right? Is that when you're talking about absorption or stages of absorption, even in genre practice, we talk about absorption, right? So I think there has to be some clarification as to what we mean by, as we go deeper into absorption, there may be a better and better ability to inhibit distraction distracted objects.
So that's why it's a flow rather than just a, you know, kind of like somebody on their phone going down the rabbit hole and just getting lost in the, you know, TikTok or something, you know, like, oh, 2 hours went by. I didn't realize. This is like, you literally are like a lot of scientists and, you know, solving a problem. You're going into it and you enter the world. You just enter that world and you're solving it, and you have probably have gamma going on, and you're just in it, and it's just like come out like, wow, I got it, you know. And but you were gone. Nobody around you. You didn't know what the environment was happening.
Well, this is where I feel like a lot of the literature gets confusing.
Yeah,
because you might say, well, someone who is in that zone, that point guard is running down the court, and they're in that zone, but they may not be aware of anything else that's happening around them, or at least be able to selectively pull from experiences that are coming from other aspects of their conscious experience. They're so in the zone, and this happened in someone who's a musician or someone who's
a musician,
an artist,
good one.
Right?
And this like a musician in an orchestra or a jazz musician or someone in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. So they kind of have to be aware of what's going on around them. Right?
And this is in contrast to, say, someone who's anxious, is also very good at being highly focused, but on usually something that is like a thought or a feeling, without being able to draw from any other experience. Like they don't see, their blinders are on, such that they don't
even
have awareness of
not just anxious, but even fear-driven or anger-driven people, which is what I think a lot of the fuel is for successful people. They deal with their default mode by going into task mode and being driven into go, 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 do, 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 do. And that's how they, and then they go to sleep and they get up again. You know, and that's their attempt to overdo the task mode, driven not in a flow, so they're not enjoying it, but they're, you know, success, success, success. But they're not, you know, getting taken over by daydreaming much, and they're trying to run as fast as they can away from trauma and anxiety, and you know, and they're they are anxious, but they don't even, if you ask them, are you anxious? No, what are you talking about? I'm just full of energy, you know, like, so that's a lot of our culture. And those people often don't come and meditate.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They already understand it. They don't need it. But the subtle part, the subtle differences between the panoramic and the
absorbed
sort of deeper sort of concentration that happens in flow is I think a critical one that I think is worth further unpacking, because most of the time when we're in, so if you think of panoramic flow, do you see that as really a way to just characterize what happens in non-dual awareness or in? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's more like, so when I say, I say to people when I teach, I say, you've experienced moments of awakened consciousness already. In fact, you do what you love in order to experience awakened consciousness. It's natural. It's already in, you know, it's not something esoteric. And then I say, what do you do that you love? walk the dog, play with children, play music, you know, go surfing, dance. Mm-hmm. As it's, what happens when you do that? Well, I drop out of myself. I feel connected to everyone. I feel happy. I feel, you know, and are you functioning? Are you sitting on a cushion? Are you withdrawn? No, I'm totally engaged. I'm aware of what's going on. I'm, some of them are a little more absorbed. You could say that something like surfing could have moments of absorbed and panoramic or something, because you have to be really detailed in the wave, and then you're aware of the wave behind you and to the side of you. So, but it's a little more panoramic.
Yeah, but that critical distinction of being aware of the wave behind you is the critical difference between something,
yes,
where there's absorption,
right,
with the ability to switch at will.
Yes, exactly.
And without being caught up in whatever you're being absorbed in,
yes,
so much so that the absorption has a benefit to being absorbed, right?
That's
like,
right,
you're in your peak, you're in,
yeah,
your peak state, and you don't want to be carried by something that's that could be a possible object of,
yes,
distraction. The panoramic,
yeah,
flow, if you're able,
yeah,
to move into that state, allows,
yes,
you to switch at will if you're,
yes,
if you would like.
Yes, I found it easier to go into the panoramic, and because I have a little ADD and dyslexia, when I wrote my first book, it took me so long, and then I made this distinction. I said, okay, well, you got to go in, if you're going to write, you got to, you know, watch those resistant parts that keep, the editor comes up, the critic comes in. It's like, you got to go into that world of writing and just enjoy it, and all of a sudden, I wrote my first book in 9 years and my second book in 9 months.
Well, that's fantastic. And I think that for the benefit of your audience, I would,
yeah,
say that in general, meditation training,
yeah,
and the way that you train it too, specifically with the pointing out the way instructions and moving through those, mm-hmm, stages of moving into non-dual experiences, there is a difference between just suppressing the,
yes,
default mode network, and then also having the skillful ability to toggle, mm, between conceptual, propositional, and non-conceptual,
mm-hmm,
processes.
Mm-hmm.
So my take on the literature, at least on neuroscience, is that the more advanced you are as a practitioner, it is not that you can suppress that default mode better.
Okay. Yeah.
But more that you can skillfully toggle between,
okay,
the default mode and a more non-conceptual form of awareness.
So is there anything you'd like to let us know that you're working on now, or the things you're up to, or how we can find you? Or
I'm still doing some work at Vanderbilt. And we're doing, I'll just mention really briefly, some of the work we're looking at is the glymphatic system, and which looks, it's a part of the brain, it's a system in the brain that clears metabolic waste products. So it's clearing the gunk out of the system. We know that sleep improves the functioning of this system. And now we're studying meditators and seeing that, in fact, meditation helps improve the function of the system, such that if you have a dysfunctioning glymphatic system, an inability to clear the system, right? If you have poor sleeping habits, you're going to have dysfunctional glymphatic system. You're not clearing up the waste efficiently. It leads to neurodegenerative disorders, MS, Alzheimer's, just cognitive decline in general is associated with a dysfunctional glymphatic system. And so we're showing that the meditators, through meditation practice, you can actually improve that system. That's really cool work. I'm really excited about that. And that's still happening. Vanderbilt, I'm working, actually, you can find my most of my work through the website contemplativeneurosciences.com, and you'll see my work at Vanderbilt there. I'm just starting to collaborate at the University of Virginia Contemplative Sciences Center and the International Society for Contemplative Research. I'm on the executive committee for this new society, ISCR. And you can find them also at contemplativeresearch.com. And so that's a great area if you're interested in contemplative science, contemplative neuroscience, check those two websites out. You'll see what's happening across all the sciences and disciplines.
This has been a real joy. It's always fun just to hang out and talk about all this stuff, and look forward to seeing you again in person at some near future, and really appreciate you sharing this with everyone.
All right, Locke. Thank you for inviting me on your podcast and to all your listeners. Look forward to engaging with you another time.
Effortless focus. Unlike the freedom of awake awareness, when we discover awareness energy, we feel a unity with everything. When we are looking from awareness energy, we can focus effortlessly. So begin by taking a nice, easy breath. Notice the sense of thinking happening in your head. And have local awareness unhook from thinking and drop down to feel your jaw from within your jaw. Notice that awareness is not looking up to thought, nor stretching attention down. Feel local awareness drop below your neck to an open space within your body, where you're directly aware of space, vibration, and awareness. Now open awareness to the space in the room. And become aware of mingling awareness with space. Feel a sense of open space that is silently aware. Now see what it's like to be aware of spacious awake awareness as boundlessly as possible. And notice that this boundless, timeless awareness is aware by itself, without any help. Notice that your view is a spacious awake awareness for a moment or two. And feel that when you turn to be aware of anything, you are aware from a field of interconnected, all-pervasive, intelligent awareness energy. Rather than looking from the sky of spacious awareness, notice the feeling of interconnection with sound, light, and energy on a subtle level. Feel as if everything that arises is made of awake awareness. Feel the unity of awareness energy as you perceive that you are not separate from anything. From the field of awareness energy, notice the feeling of your whole body arising like a wave from the ocean of awareness energy. From here, become interested in one point of contact within your body where your breath is arising at your belly or your chest. Begin to focus on the sensation and movement of your breath in this small area. Once you feel your belly or chest begin to rise, label it one. Then feel a natural pause at the top of the in-breath. Be aware of awareness energy from all around and within the pause before the out-breath. Then feel the point of contact on your skin as your breath goes out and label it two. Feel the pause before the next in-breath and rest in the unity of embodied awareness energy. Your breath is happening by itself. Awareness energy is aware by itself without creating a point of view. Continue to focus effortlessly as you label each following breath in and out. Just noticing that you're aware from the field of awareness that's arising like an ocean of awareness connecting your breath and your body. So you can feel the focus from within and all around. As a natural connection, and even the background movement does not take you away from this interconnected focus from awareness energy. Enjoy. We offer this podcast freely thanks to the donations of kind listeners like you. If you'd like to be a supporter of this podcast, please visit lockkelly.org/donate. We are grateful for your tax-deductible donation.